Even further, as defense chiefs of West Africa's regional bloc agree on a plan for a possible intervention in the West African nation after the military junta there failed to restore civilian rule following last month's coup. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has given the junta 1 week to reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum or face the potential use of force. In a statement after their meeting in Nigerian capital Abuja, ECOWAS said the bloc has taken all necessary measures for a military intervention in Niger.
All the elements that would go into any eventual intervention have been worked out here and being refined, including the timing, including the resources needed, and including how and where and when we are going to deploy such a force. We are determined to stop it.
The bloc said it is seeking democracy in the African country.
Military is not our option of choice. It is the last resort. We want diplomacy to work, and we want this message clearly transmitted to the leaders of the junta in Niger that we are giving them every opportunity to reverse what they have done and to return the country to constitutional order.
The decision to militarily intervene in Niger has been welcomed by France. In a statement, the French foreign ministry said it firmly and resolutely supported efforts by ECOWAS to reinstate former President Bazoum. The ministry added the future of Niger and the stability of the entire region are at stake. An ECOWAS delegation has also arrived in Niger's capital, Niamey, to hold talks with military officials in an effort to reverse the coup and restore the former president. In a separate reaction, Washington also said it supported ECOWAS leadership on Niger.
We strongly support the very strong leadership of ECOWAS on Niger. I don't want to get ahead of where things are, but what ECOWAS has done in terms of stating very clearly that there's an expectation for return to the constitutional order and a continuation of the democratic process.
The United States has also suspended some of its aid programs to the government in the West African nation. The developments in Niger comes nearly 2 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blocked access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdelrahman Tiani expressed support for the coup and said its priority was to avoid destabilizing the country. In an instant reaction, ECOWAS urged what it called constitutional order to be restored. The Union threatened sanctions if Niger's coup leaders failed to reinstate the ousted president. The sanctions by the ECOWAS were met with angry reactions from opponents of the pro-West former regime.
Closing borders for a country like Niger is not a good thing for a landlocked country, but we're trying to adapt. Like Mali, we're not going to die. I believe that Niger exists and will continue to exist, whatever the decision taken by ECOWAS. What I have to say to ECOWAS is that it must be for the people, not against them. So it's a system that we denounce.
But apart from all the sanctions, what has created concern among many people across Niger has been the idea of a military intervention there. It stressed that Niger belongs to Nigerians and that they will support the military in face of any intervention.
As Nigerians, we said to ourselves that if the military decided to intervene in the situation, we would be with them all the same, and we're determined to go wherever they want, and we're not even in favor of negotiations. Niger belongs to the Nigerians, so in this sense, we ask only one thing. We ask only one thing. We're asking for the withdrawal of the French from the French military base for them to go home. And we are with our soldiers today because the military are the ones defending us.
The possible military intervention in Niger also drew reaction from Russia. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it is unlikely that interventions by some non-regional forces can change the situation for the better. As for us, we are monitoring the situation very closely. Of course, we are concerned about the tensions that are now growing in the region. We remain in favor of Niger returning to its constitutional norms as soon as possible without any damage or threat to human life. Putting all the factors together in Niger's recent military coup and the subsequent reactions, what comes to the spotlight is the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians, as many of them say. Given that people of Niger have been fed up with decades of French rule over their country, what seems to be of high significance for the external powers is that they must stop intervening, either politically or militarily, in Niger, and let the people of Niger decide their own future.
A new documentary produced by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement revealed that Palestinian resistance fighters managed to infiltrate Israel's Shin Bet, a spy agency Mossad. The documentary titled Spider's Web 2 details a complex espionage operation that was carried out against the Israeli organizations by Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance movement of the Islamic Jihad, which is headquartered in the Tel Aviv-blockaded Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The documentary illustrates the espionage enterprise, which involved six Palestinian fighters and was part of a wider operation launched by the Islamic Jihad in 2022 to retaliate against Israeli warfare in Gaza. The Israeli military launched close to 150 airstrikes against the coastal sliver during the war, prompting the resistance to respond by firing some 1,100 rockets toward the occupied territories. The Palestinian agents reportedly baited a number of Israeli officers into revealing secret methods and procedures. One of the Palestinian operatives, referred to as Recruit 106, duped a Shin Bet officer into believing that he was afraid of being arrested by the Palestinian resistance fighters, thus luring the Israeli officer into revealing a treasure trove of information on the regime's security system, methods, and tools. The Palestinian agents also managed to find out how Shin Bet agents had, in the past, tried to pose themselves as Palestinian Authority officers, Jordanian intelligence agents, and even a European Union representative on one occasion. According to the documentary, the Palestinian move led to the detention of several agents working for Israel and the dismantling of at least three Israeli spying centers. The successful conduct of the operation, according to the documentary, led to the Al-Quds Brigades debunking the myth of might that surrounds the Israeli regime and its capabilities, with the Palestinian fighters identifying the regime as no more than an illusion made of dust. The term was famously used by Mahmoud al-Arida, one of the six Palestinian prisoners who successfully escaped an Israeli maximum security prison in September 2021. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, which took power in late December, has thrown Tel Aviv into unprecedented turmoil with its push to overhaul the regime's judicial system. Many of the former senior officials present at the December conference have become highly public dissidents, warning of the damage to Israel's security by the agenda and even supporting the refusal by thousands of military reservists to serve the regime. By every metric, the Israeli economy has suffered, while scientists, doctors, and tech entrepreneurs either prepare immigration plans or march in the streets alongside hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. The Israel Medical Association said nearly 500 doctors are expected to leave Israel, warning that the exodus can lead to a severe medical crisis. Israel is no longer as strong or as stable as it was mere months ago. Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz recently warned of a worrying security situation across the occupied territories amid a months-long wave of anti-regime protests sparked by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet and its contentious policies. Last week, after Israeli parliament passed the first of the judicial overhaul bill, sparing mass protests, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah described it as the worst day in the history of the Zionist entity. He said, "Israel has embarked on a path, God willing, of collapse, fragmentation, and doom."
Top rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S.'s credit rating over its rising debt and a, quote, deterioration in the standards of governance. Fitch is one of the big three rating agencies. It has dropped the credit rating to AA+, down one notch from the highest rating AAA. The lower credit rating could over time raise borrowing costs for the U.S. government. The lower credit rating provides investors with a guide of the risks associated with investing in the debt of a particular country. The move could cause investors to sell U.S. treasuries, leading to a spike in yields that serve as references for interest rates on a variety of loans. Fitch has pointed to the expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years, a high and growing general government debt burden, and the erosion of governance relative to other countries with similar rating over the past 20 years. Fitch predicts a growing government deficit, noting that the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio was currently at 100.1%, 2.5 times higher than the AAA-rated country's median of 39.3%.
It is important. It is relevant. The question is, of course, is this a canary in the coal mine for other similar downgrades? And I would say, is it a lagging or a leading indicator? I mean, this dance around the debt ceiling goes on year after year, where we're quite familiar with it. It's not a surprise. It was actually less drama this time around than before. So why is it now that the governance has been called out? I do think it's significant that it's been compared to other developed economies, because the governance, is it demonstrably worse here in the US than other developed economies? Or is this just, it may perhaps it falls short of what it should be?
Fitch has also cited the Federal Reserve's recent credit rate hikes, weakening business investment, and a slowdown in consumption to predict a mild recession in the fourth quarter of 2023 and the first quarter of 2024. The decision was viewed by observers as another embarrassing blow to the U.S. government, which had long been rated as one of the safest borrowers in global finance.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is a steady deterioration that we've seen in some of the key metrics for the United States for a number of years. Debt to GDP in 2007, general government debt was less than 60%, and now it's 113%. So there's been a clear deterioration. Furthermore, we're expecting fiscal deficits to rise over the next 3 years, and we expect debt to continue to rise over the next 3 years. And furthermore, because of the higher interest rates and the higher stock of debt, we're now seeing the interest burden rise pretty fast, actually, in the case of the United States. So the underlying numbers are, especially on the fiscal and debt side, are quite negative.
Fitch's downgrade comes roughly 3 months after U.S. President Joe Biden signed a deal to raise the debt limit, just days before the U.S. was expected to default on the national debt. The last time the U.S. credit rating was downgraded was in 2011, following a similar budget showdown that came within hours of the government defaulting on its debts. The reputed credit rating agency has warned that the growing debt, which is now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way pose threats to the country's creditworthiness. Both administration officials strongly criticized the rating cut. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the decision was arbitrary and based on outdated information.
Its flawed assessment is based on outdated data and fails to reflect improvements across a range of indicators, including those related to governance, that we've seen over the past 2.5 years.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Fitch's decision defies reality when the U.S. had the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world. But U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the country's credit rating by a notch from AAA to AA+. An index designed to track turns in U.S. business cycles fell for the 15th straight month in June, dragged down by a weakening consumer outlook and increased unemployment claims, marking the longest streak of decreases since the lead-up to the 2007-09 recession.
But the bigger picture, Fitch has exactly right. We are on an unsustainable fiscal path. The ultimate consequence probably isn't a missed Treasury payment, but it's probably a disastrous run of inflation when we try to monetize a debt we can't afford.
The Conference Board, which is a leading business membership and research group organization, has reiterated its forecast that the U.S. economy is likely to be in a recession from the current third quarter to the first quarter of 2024. Elevated prices, tighter monetary policy, harder to get credit, and reduced government spending are poised to dampen economic growth further. Since inflation is still higher than the Federal Reserve would like it to be, policymakers are widely expected to raise interest rates by another 0.25 percentage point. These rate increases make it more expensive to get a car loan or to finance a business or to carry a balance on a credit card.
Thank you. night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Well, the concept and the topic that we are going to delve into related to the Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani is mourning. And that is the mourning for Imam Hussein and Muharram. And this is actually a good platform for me and the whole crew here from the IRIB English Radio to express our condolences to everybody who's listening to us, to our dear audiences. And inshallah, we hope that this program would come to good use. Let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani and then we'll be back.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws related to mourning, in fact, to commemorate Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary during Muharram. According to the laws issued or fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani, let me ask you this question. What is the Islamic law about beating drums during Muharram?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, beating drums is common in some Muslim countries on the day of Ashura, especially in Iran. Of course, mourners come with their drums and they start beating drums, of course. As far as I know, none of the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sistani, are opposed to beating drums. So beating drums is permissible in and of itself. provided that, of course, it is confined to beating drums, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, people do not go overboard using other, let's say, musical instruments, playing music, because music is one thing, beating drum is another thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Beating drums even was common in the early period of Islam. They used to beat drums, okay?
Yes.
And, of course, it has a philosophy, a concept, which we need to understand as to why beating drums is allowed. Of course, in the early period of Islam, when Muslims were going to war against, for example, a group of, let's say, non-Muslims or opponents, mm-hmm. let's say, they used to beat drums to, let's say, to scare them.
Yes, especially in wars. Yeah,
yeah, beating wars.
Yes.
But in this time around, of course, beating drums is allowed because it's also recognized as a means or as a tool for commemorating the event of Ashura.
Yes.
And, of course, there's no objection to it.
I see. You also hinted at the other musical instruments. You said if they don't go overboard to play other musical instruments. What about flute or trumpet? These are also the instruments which are used in some of these mourning processions.
Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is strongly opposed to using flute and trumpet. Only drum is allowed.
Uh-huh.
No other musical instruments, because when musical instruments are played, okay, flute is also a kind of musical instrument, okay?
Yes.
Because you can play with flute different, let's say, you can just use the flute to create different kinds of sounds, okay?
Yes.
Some of the sounds may not be appealing and may not be considered appropriate. So,
but it's not a happy sound or music coming out of flute.
Yeah,
flute is usually, by nature, it's very sad.
It's not sad. It can be very happy as well. You know, it's only in some countries where flute is used for creating sad sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But flute can also be used to create very happy sounds. So therefore, since it's it can be misused mm-hmm. by people, and when permission, if permission is given, then it will know no bound. Okay, people will go overboard. They will go to extremes using flute and other musical instruments. Therefore, it's not permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to play musical instruments whatsoever.
I see. Okay, let's take a very short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion on the laws related to mourning during Muharram, according to Ayatollah Sistani.
Sure.
Stay with us.
Stars, your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. To me, desire, dreams are water. Desire.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the laws according to Ayatollah Sistani about mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein's martyrdom during Muharram. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law about wedding or nikah in the month of Muharram and Safar?
Well, nikah itself or per se is permissible because it's highly recommended to get married. And there are some people who are under the impression that nikah is not allowed, okay? Because the thing nikah means happiness, nikah is coupled with music, nikah is coupled or twixt with something which is forbidden, well, nikah can be without music, nikah can be without anything like that. So nikah is to make two persons, two individuals halal for each other.
Yes.
And it's a permissible act. It is even recommended, and according to the religion, it is half of iman, okay?
Yes.
And a person who gets married has actually completed half of his faith and half of his iman, and he should observe piety for the other half.
Mm-hmm.
Observe piety, God consciousness for the other half.
Yes.
So there is no problem in having your nikah done on the day of Ashura, even on the day of Ashura, okay?
Yes.
But we should understand that wedding is not allowed. Wedding means calling people and giving them a feast and then celebrating and wearing new clothes, because this is what we understand from wedding, okay?
Yes.
Of course, it's not permissible because it amounts to disrespect. It's a kind of disregard to Muharram, and mm-hmm. we have to respect Muharram. Just as I said, the concept of Muharram is to respect those symbols and remember the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We cannot remember the suffering of Imam Hussein and his companions by having your celebration which goes against the whole yes. concept.
Exactly.
So it's not permissible. Wedding is not allowed, but yes. nikah is permissible.
Nikah, by nikah you mean the day or the time where and when the marriage formula is pronounced.
It's pronounced.
Not the wedding ceremony.
Not the wedding ceremony.
Yes.
Okay. That's what nikah means, marriage contract.
Yes.
Which can be concluded or solemnized on the day of Ashura.
Okay. And the other question, Sheikh Javed, is it permissible for a man to take part in a procession or a mourning ceremony where you cannot avoid coming in contact with women? In other words, your body touches their body, and that is something that happens without you having it under control.
Well, that's also a good question. You know that on the day of, let's say, Ashura, people do come out into the streets. If a person doesn't know and does not have such an intention
mm-hmm.
to make his body touch the body of a non-mahram, okay, there's no problem coming into the streets. Because we do know that women are there, men are there, and all of them can come out into the streets and actually mourn for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. But if one knows that if he goes into the crowd,
mm-hmm.
his body will come in contact with the body of a woman, and he will end up touching a woman. It's not permissible. No, none of the religious authorities actually allows coming in contact with a non-mahram, okay?
Yes.
Allowing your body to touch the body of a woman is not permissible. And if one knows that it's going to happen, it's not permissible. Not, even if it's not intentional, because when you know that such a thing will happen, it's not permissible to go in and let your body touch the body of a non-mahram woman.
Yes, and it doesn't matter whether it is indoor or outdoor, because some of the groups of procession you can see in some areas around the mosque, or
yeah.
even in some of the areas related to or affiliated with the shrines.
Yes.
You know, it happens so that or such that some of these mourning groups, in fact, enter and come out of those places. So it would be very much, which we call it, hectic and busy in those and crowded in those areas. So it's not permissible to go in that area?
When you know that you will end up touching a non-mahram woman, of course, it's not permissible. Generally speaking, mixed gatherings are not encouraged at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is on the day of Ashura for mourning the suffering of Imam Hussein, or it is a wedding, mixed gatherings are not allowed when it leads to such sins.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Javid. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts, works, and life accounts of the most important companions of Prophet Muhammad and the Shi'ite infallible Imam Zain Ata, the host of this program. With me are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi. It's good to be here.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most important companions and the special companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, whose name was Qanbar. What information do we have about the early life and the biography of Qanbar, Sheikh Rouhani?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Qanbar was among the servants of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wassalam, not only a servant but also one of the very close companions of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. And it is said he was originally from the ancient Persia, Iran. His name in Farsi is called Ghambar, which has two parts, Ghambar. So the one who takes Gham, or sadness, we can say. So, of course, he participated and took part in many of the battles, like Siffin, and finally he was killed by Hajjaj ibn Yusuf al-Thaqafi.
That's right.
And he was buried, I think, in Hims or Kufa. Two places are mentioned as his grave. Then, of course, he was one of the very devoted servants and companions of Amirul Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam, who was actually always with Amirul Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam and serving the household of Amirul Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right.
And was like a guard. It is said that he was also among the Shortatul Khamis, which was a kind of special guard or special forces for the Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam, who was, they were protecting Amir al-Mu'mineen against the enemies.
That's right.
Yeah, these are the early life of the Qanbar.
That's right. So he was originally from Persia, as you said.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Sayyid Mahdi Qanbar is usually known as the symbol and the epitome of faithfulness and servitude to Imam Ali alayhi salam. So some might criticize nowadays the people that, what kind of Islamic life is this? A person having, for example, a servant or something like that. Let's explain a little bit about this. How much he was faithful to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Why at all this status was given to him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think first and foremost, it's important to know that this personality of Qanbar is a very well-known personality. And it does, he has a very special place in the history of Islam, and that too with Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. And a lot of the traditions and a lot of the historical aspects that we know about Qanbar, he is referred to as a servant of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, the concept of servitude and slavery, you know, in this kind of era, the era of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, this is a concept which is well over 1,000 years old. So when you put time and place into consideration, it doesn't have the same connotation that slavery does in the modern, you know, day, circa.
That's right. And they were usually not called a slave. They were called, for example, servant or something like that, isn't it?
Right. So a kind of a historical aspect to it, you find that there were many people who didn't have jobs. There were many people, you know, who weren't employed, but they had families, they had women, they had children. And so one of the ways that people at that age would resolve this was this kind of indentured servitude, which, you know, is misrepresented as slavery, you know. Yes. So they would receive food, they would receive clothing, you know, at times they would receive housing from these individuals who, quote unquote, employed them for different various works. Now, some people worked inside the house, you know, and famous examples are like individuals such as Her Eminence Lady Fidda, and in this case, His Eminence Qanbar. Individuals who were very loyal to their, you know, quote unquote, masters. There were some people who worked in the fields. And when you see Islam came into the picture and the Messenger of Allah came with the message of Islam, prior to that, these servants who worked in the house or in the field, they were mistreated, they were oppressed, they were taken advantage of, you know, as we said, because they were looking for work, they were looking for income, you know, risk, sustenance.
Yes.
So people took advantage of them,
yes.
You know, not too different from the modern age. But the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, they taught us to be just to these people, to be fair, to be kind, to treat them in similar manners. And so when specifically talking about Qanbar, there's a very interesting story where Imam Ali, alayhi as-salam, right, the commander of the believers, goes to the market to buy a shirt. He buys two shirts.
Okay.
Right? One is a little bit more expensive. One is a little bit less expensive. Mm-hmm. And he goes with Qanbar. And so he ends up giving the shirt that was more expensive to Qanbar, who we say, quote unquote, is his servant. And Amir al-Mu'mineen himself, he took the shirt which was less expensive to, you know, and a very real lesson on fairness and justice. At that time, it was servitude. Perhaps it could be loosely called slavery, but in the modern age, this is employment, and I think important values that come out of it.
That's all right. As I said, all along, after all these years, when they want to refer to, for example, a person who is very much faithful to the infallibles, they remind us the story of Qanbar and what happened in his life with Imam Ali alayhi salam. In the outstanding, we can't say poems, we can't say by outstanding and famous Persian poets like Hafez, like Maulana, the name Qanbar is referred to, okay? So up to an extent that they say you cannot reach the status of Qanbar, the servant of Amir al-Mu'minin, let alone to Ali alayhi salam, okay? In his faithfulness, in his generosity, and something like that.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani. For example, we have Qanbar Khani in the Persian was something, it is like something like ta'ziyah or passion play, okay? So the story and the important parts of the life of Qanbar is recounted for the people around. And even the people distribute their nuzurat in the name of Qanbar. This is very important. See how much important this servant must be. But I think after some years, he is now more than a servant to Imam Ali alayhi salam. He becomes maybe, I don't know, a man to the secrets of Ali alayhi salam, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Regarding slavery, our audience or listeners should understand that this modern concept of slavery is totally different from what we had in Islam.
Yes.
Because before Islam, we had this slavery in different forms, in different modes, models, I mean. And Islam only accepted and confirmed one type, which was that they took slaves from the battlefield when the soldiers attacked, for example, Islamic areas. And in the battlefield, when Muslims were defending themselves, so of course they took some people or some soldiers as captives.
Yes.
So only these people could be taken as slaves. Then the rest of the types of slavery were completely rejected and denied by Islam.
That's right.
And when someone was taken as a slave, because there was no any other better choice for slaves, you know, because of what? Because you cannot kill all the slaves at once. It's inhuman thing, action actually.
Yes.
And you cannot free them and let them go back to the army of the enemy. It's also okay. Really dangerous.
Okay.
And you cannot let them to go to the Islamic society without any care, you know. So that's why the best, and also you cannot imprison all those thousands of people from the battlefield. Again, it's a kind of inhuman action because you deprive them from all the different kind of communications, facilities, services. So the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam told the Muslims that you can take them as your children, you know, and we have the ahadith told Muslims that you have to call them as my daughter, my son. You should not call them as a slave. That's why we see this highest level of devotion and loyalty to Amir al-Mu'minin, what we see from Qanbar. It's not only Qanbar, the rest of the slaves or the servants of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, are all of the same because they treated them as their children, as their daughter, as their son, as their family members.
Yes.
That is why we should not think that, for example, Muslims were attacking, for example, an area and took all the free people.
Yes.
As slaves, as the European, modern European did with the Africans.
That's right.
It was not like that. So that's why we have a budget. We have a specific kind of budget for freeing Muslims, freeing slaves. As we have in our fiqh, we have Kitab al-Itq. We do not have Kitab al-Istirqaq. Kitab al-Itq. Kitab al-Itq means that how can we free them?
Yes.
Step by step, gradually. We have a specific budget from, zakat.
Yes.
One portion of zakat should be dedicated to the slaves to free them.
Yes.
And also with different very simple kind of excuses, the people freed their, slaves, as Imam Sajjad once, he was washing his head and a slave was helping him. And once the dish fell down, And then the slave told Imam Sajjad that, "Wal kadhimin al ghayz," only informing Imam Sajjad of this nice phrase of ayah of the Quran. And Imam Sajjad said, "You are free." Sometimes with very, very simple, very kind of, what you can say, minute kind of excuses, the servants were gotten free. So this is the point that should be mentioned regarding the devotion of this Qambar, what we see, or his loyalty to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, that he's sometimes protecting Imam Ali during the night time. Even Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was not aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Secretly.
Yes.
He was protecting Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. He was already ready to sacrifice himself for the sake of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of relationship
how
is there?
How is it that a servant between, can get to that place?
So, of course, this servant, what we had in Islam, is totally different. That's why our audience should not mix it with the modern kind of slavery that we had in modern world.
Modern type of slavery, the slaves are, because they're running away from their masters.
Yeah, of course.
Even they are ready to kill their masters rather than protecting them. See how much kind the infallible Imams and Prophet Muhammad were to their servants. The story of his Shahada is also, Sayyid Mahdi, is interesting. I mean, Qambar was killed by the order of Hajjaj ibn Yusuf al-Saqafi. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Apparently in the research that we came across, it is said that Qambar, this faithful follower, this faithful companion, this faithful servant of Imam Ali alayhi salam, was apparently martyred by the order of Hajjaj bin Yusuf Thaqafi. Just kind of a background, this individual, Hajjaj bin Yusuf, was very bloodthirsty. He was very cruel, and he was definitely one of the greatest tyrants of his time, Hajjaj bin Yusuf, right?
Yes.
He's famous for being this kind of a murderous individual. Apparently, Qambar was taken to Hajjaj bin Yusuf, and Hajjaj bin Yusuf asked him, he said, you know, what did you do for Imam Ali? And Qambar, peace and blessings upon him, he said that I prepared water for the wudu of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so then Hajjaj bin Yusuf asked him, what did Imam Ali alayhi salam say during his wudu? Qambar then continues, he replies that when Imam Ali alayhi salam used to finish his wudu, he would say the ayahs of the Holy Quran, which Imam Ali alayhi salam used to recite, chapter number 6, verses 44 and 45.
Yes, Surah An'am, ayahs 44 and 45, that's right.
So in order to understand what the verses were, I think we should kind of recite it. So it says that, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, when they forgot what they had been admonished of, what they had been warned of, we opened up for them the gates of all things. When they rejoiced in what they were given, we seized them suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, behold, they were despondent, they were tyrants. Thus the wrongdoing lot were rooted out, and all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds.
Yes.
Right? So Hajjaj bin Yusuf, after he hears this, he says that, I think that Amir al-Mu'mineen, or well, in this case, the Holy Quran, meant us tyrants by these verses. And so Qambar says, yes, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he was talking about you guys and how you're tyrannical and you think that, you know, you have all these blessings, but in reality, you know, you are the tyrants and Allah will root you out. And then Hajjaj bin Yusuf, he just randomly all of a sudden says, what would you do if I cut your head off?
Mm-hmm.
And so Qambar replies, he says, I will be fortunate and you will be unfortunate. And then Hajjaj bin Yusuf, this very murderous, tyrannical individual, goes ahead and orders to have the head of Qambar cut off. It's really interesting here, just this one statement from Qambar, that he says that I will be fortunate and you will be unfortunate, in response to what would you do if my head was cut off.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, you know, reminiscent of this whole concept of martyrdom and shahadat. And for example, later on to come, you will find Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the martyrs of Karbala.
Yes.
This idea that if we die, you know, on the path of Allah, for the sake of Allah, we are fortunate. And whoever the enemy is who is killing us, they will always be unfortunate. They will always lose.
That's all right. مردی ز کننده در خیبر پرس و اسرار کرم ز خواجه قنبر پرس. گر طالب فیض حق شدستی حافظ سرچشمه آن ز ساقی Kawsar Pour. So he refers to Khwaja Qanbar as Asrar Karam. He is in fact a way to the secrets of the life of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, as the most faithful becomes a servant of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Being around them, just experiencing the life around the Ahlul Bayt, had so many blessings for these servants, up to an extent that they could reach a high status, maybe more than the ulama during the history of Islam. These servants could benefit from the blessings and the mercies of the life of the Ahlul Bayt. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mahdi and Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Qanbar, the special servant of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and among the faithful companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It was very kind of you. Thank you, Sayyid Mahdi.
Jazakallah, thank you.
And Shaykh Rouhani, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that President Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that former President Donald Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results, disputing the characterization of their interactions made by some members of Trump's legal team. "That's not what happened," Mike Pence said during an interview with Face the Nation that aired on Sunday, 6th of August. "From sometime in the middle of December, the president began to be told that I had some authority to reject or return votes back to the states." He added, "I had no such authority." On Tuesday, 1st of August, Donald Trump was indicted for a second time on federal charges. This most recent indictment stemmed from his efforts to remain in power after losing the 2020 presidential election, efforts which culminated in the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The indictment included four charges against Trump: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. One of the allegations against Donald Trump is that he attempted to enlist Mike Pence to use his ceremonial role in affirming the electoral vote count on 6th of January 2021 to fraudulently overturn the results of the election. Mike Pence has said Donald Trump went beyond asking him to pause the count for an audit and urged him to reject the Biden electors outright in the hopes of tipping the election in Trump's favor. "There was no discretion ever given to the vice president in history, nor should there ever be," Mike Pence told Face the Nation. "I had no right to overturn the election, and Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024. John Lauro, an attorney for Donald Trump, responded to Mike Pence's comments on Sunday, telling Face the Nation that his position is consistent with Pence's version of events. "What I said is the ultimate ask of Vice President Pence was to pause the count and allow the states to weigh in. That was my statement, and what I've said is consistent with what Vice President Mike Pence is saying. The reason why Vice President Pence will be so important to the defense is Number one, he agrees that John Eastman, who gave legal advice to President Trump, was an esteemed legal scholar. Number two, he agrees that there were election irregularities, fraud, unlawful actions at the state level. All of that will eviscerate any allegation of criminal intent on the part of President Trump. The indictment refers to contemporaneous notes taken by the vice president in the weeks leading up to 6th of January 2021, when prosecutors alleged Trump repeatedly pressured him to reject the electoral votes. From time to time, particularly at important moments, I had a practice of scribbling a note or two on my calendar just to memorialize it and remember it, and I did that in this case, he told Face the Nation. I generally didn't make a practice of taking notes in meetings over the four-year period of time. But given the momentous events that were unfolding, he said he took a few notes to remind himself of what had been said. From very early on, the very first time the president raised the issue with me that he was being told that I had the right to overturn the election to reject or return votes, I told him I knew I had no such authority. I truly do believe that no one whoever puts himself over the Constitution should ever be President of the United States. The former Vice President also recalled an occasion before Christmas 2020 when Donald Trump asked him what he thought we ought to do. We were just the two of us in the Oval Office, Pence said. I remember I looked at him and said, look, let all the lawsuits play out, let the Congress do their work to consider objections. But I said at the end of the day, if the election goes the other way, I said we ought to take a bow, we ought to travel around the country, he said. And I remember the president is standing in front of his desk, listening very intently to me, and I'll never forget the way he just kind of pointed at me as if to say that's worth thinking about. Mike Pence added, but I don't know what was in his mind at the time. When asked if he would testify in the case against Donald Trump, if the case against Donald Trump went to trial, Mike Pence said he would, if summoned. We'll respond to the call of the law if it comes to it, and we'll just tell the truth. He also added that he would hope that Donald Trump would receive a fair trial in the District of Columbia. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's attorney on Sunday, 6th of August, welcomed former Vice President Mike Pence potentially testifying at Trump's future trial related to his push to overturn the 2020 election. But Trump's lawyer wouldn't discuss if Trump will do the same. John Lauro argued on ABC's This Week program that Mike Pence, who is a key figure in Trump's unprecedented third indictment, could actually be beneficial to Trump, despite Mike Pence rebuking Trump for urging him to stop the certification of their defeat on 6th of January 2021, when Congress convened at the Capitol and Pence presided in a ceremonial role. John Lauro maintained that Mike Pence, if called to testify, would agree that Trump wasn't acting with criminal intent in seeking to stay in power and reverse his loss. Mike Pence will be one of our best witnesses at trial. I cannot wait until I have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Pence, Lauro told the This Week program with George Stephanopoulos. Based on what the Vice President Pence will say, the government will never be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump had corrupt or criminal intent. And that's what this case is all about, Lauro contended. Donald Trump denies breaking any laws and has pleaded not guilty to the four charges in his third indictment: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. This is a persecution of a political opponent, he claimed after his arraignment in Washington on Thursday, 3rd of August. Pressed by George Stephanopoulos on Sunday if Donald Trump would be willing to go under oath to challenge Mike Pence's version of events, John Lauro responded by saying, "That's impossible to say right now. What we have to see is what the Biden administration is going to put on as evidence."